You are about to witness history in the making. Despite the world's highest living standards, the average American remained vaguely discontent, aware that his goal of a better way of life had still not been fully realized. There was something missing.
There's this awful gap in our lives just because we don't have... Oh, but why talk about it?
It's just that... Oh, I keep hoping someone can find a way to...
Don't be a fool, Mary. You know that's impossible.
Oh, I know. It's just that...
Gad, it's ironic. With all our technology and industrial know-how, we still don't have the one thing that could give us a better way of life.
It's the Forgotten Filmcast.
It was a pleasant Saturday afternoon, and my son Bill and I had been shopping.
Welcome to episode 190 of the Forgotten Filmcast. My name is Todd Liebenow, and thanks for joining me for this look at the movies that time forgot. On this episode, I'll be joined by William Garver from It Came From the Bottom Shelf to discuss a 1935 movie with a title that has nothing to do with the movie itself. Starring W.C. Fields, Mary Bryan, and Kathleen Howard, directed by Clyde Brookman. It's Man on the Flying Trapeze. But first...
Joan and Frank thank Mr. Grant for repairing the flashlight and for showing them some things about...
The Forgotten Filmcast.
Hi. You hungry? Looking for a tempting treat? Hold on till I absorb some heat. Some added tang might please you too. I'll slide into an oven-fresh bun, and I'm ready for your eating fun.
Why don't you try a juicy good hot dog? Mmm, delicious.
Visit our snack bar and treat yourself to some delicious Castleberry's pit-cooked barbecue sandwiches. Cook the Castleberry way, slowly over open pits of glowing charcoal, then season with a sauce that's zesty, yet delightfully mild to please the entire family. Also at the snack bar, you'll find popcorn and soft drinks and candy and French fries to go with your Castleberry's barbecue sandwiches. There's plenty of time before the movie starts, so visit our snack bar right now for Castleberry's pit-cooked barbecue sandwiches.
Drive away your worries and cares at this drive-in theater, where you will see the finest motion pictures of all time soon to be released. Drama, comedy, adventure, excitement, something for everyone. Here's a brief glimpse of some of the truly fine pictures we've scheduled in the near future.
An ancient Aztec legend tells of a god who descended to earth from the stars at the dawn of time and became the father of the first Puma Man.
You are the Puma Man.
The Puma Man.
The Puma Man. We must find him and kill him. must obey me, I will destroy your powers.
Ah!
I will destroy your mind. You belong to me now.
I kill you, Dr. Jones!
Calm yourself. If you go, you're lost. They'll kill you.
What do you want?
The gold mask.
Oh, incredible.
The Puma Man.
There's a high probability it's him.
What's your plan?
To follow them until I find out where the mask is.
Let go of me! Let go!
I want to know where Cobras is hiding the mask.
I don't know.
And now, on with the show.
Morning. Morning. Well, I had quite an experience last night apprehending those criminals.
Yeah, and it was funny the way the whole thing turned out.
Yes, it was.
Yes, it was. Indeed, it was. It'll be harder than ever for poor Claude to secure employment when they know that his brother-in-law is an ex-convict.
I don't think I should even look for work. Until this whole thing blows over.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
He isn't an ex-convict. He wasn't in the jail a half hour.
He was convicted of manufacturing alcoholic beverages without a permit.
He never made illegal liquor. He bought pure apple cider, put it in the garden, let it freeze, and then drained the alcohol off.
That's just exactly what happened, dear. Any more wheat cakes and sausage?
There would have been if you got to the table when the others got you.
I think it's a shame.
You little rebel, you here. You just have some of these ham and egg.
Oh, enough of your quarreling. I'm sick and tired of it. Oh, here's one of those delightful fragments by Gertrude Smahn. Would you like to hear it? Would you like to hear it?
Oh, yes, I would, dear. Yes, surely I would. Surely.
We have what we have not.
Have we any, sir?
What we have not, we have. Up is down, down is... Are you listening?
Oh, yes, dear. I beg your pardon, yes. Are you going to eat the rest of that sausage and...
Yes, I am.
Oh, well, that's all right.
Down is out. Everyone knew me, and I was happy. Are you listening?
Yes, dear.
And we were all happy. Is everybody happy? And I bought a big red apple. Yes, unhappiness is joy. Isn't that beautiful? Isn't that beautiful?
Very beautiful, dear, very beautiful.
What's it all about?
What you were eating?
Yes.
About an apple?
And the wonderful part of it is there's no punctuation.
Oh, that's marvelous.
And to think that under that beautiful blank verse, they print portraits of those horrible wrestlers.
Claude's going to see that wrestling match. He found a ticket, a $15 ticket in the first row. Is your toast warm, Dad?
No, dear, it's cold. It's all right. I've been cold toast for 8 years, and I like it.
All right, Dad. I'll meet you in the hall. We'll drive down together.
All right, dear.
Excuse me.
Excuse me. Excuse me, dear.
Don't forget to pay the rent on the way to the office.
Oh, no, I won't.
Please don't forget.
I won't.
Okay, our movie this time is Man on the Flying Trapeze from 1935. And joining me to discuss this film is William Garver from It Came from the Bottom Shelf. Garv, welcome back to the show.
Salutations, and allow me to extend a virtual hearty hand clasp.
Excellent, excellent. Well, before we get going here, why don't you take a moment, tell everybody a bit about yourself and what you do.
Okay, well, you know, I've been on the show a couple of times before. We previously discussed the Abbott and Costello film Whodunit and Billy Wilder's Avante. I have had a couple of different websites over the years. I started way back in 2006 with a website called Booze Movies, the 100 Proof Film Guide, which was all about alcohol and cinema from the silent era to the present day. So our film today kind of fits into that category.
It does indeed.
And then after a while, I decided that that was a little too narrow a focus, and I wanted to focus more on movies that I think are overlooked, needed more attention, very much along the same line as what you do here on this show. So I created It Came from the Bottom Shelf, which is at bottomshelfmovies.com. I'm taking a little hiatus from doing reviews, but I will poke back in and post something from time to time. But there's about 170 reviews on the website as it is right now, and they're not going away anytime soon.
Well, I mean, even if you don't have new stuff coming out, one of the things that your site is great for, I know, I think that I have gone and checked it from time to time when putting together my Christmas list each year, because you always highlight these great releases that are coming out on Blu-ray or whatever of these older films, things that are a bit off the radar. And there's a lot of times when I've seen you mention things on your site that I would have had no idea it was coming out other than the fact that you mentioned it. So I've always considered you to be a great resource for that.
Well, that's great to hear. And, one of the things that I probably will continue to do, even though I'm not posting as regularly, is I usually did a favorites, best of list towards the end of the year or the beginning of the next year, with a list of maybe 20 or so discs that I thought really needed a little extra attention. So I'll probably do that again.
So I guess what are some that just popped to your mind right away here, from, I don't know, recent months or the last year or so that you're just going, these are ones you got to get?
There's one that's actually isn't out yet, but it's coming out, I believe, next month from Kino, called Soundies, The Ultimate Collection. And I don't know if you know what Soundies were, but they were the music videos of the 1940s. Mm-hmm. They actually had special jukeboxes with a screen, very much like a television screen in it. And they would project an image to go along with the music. And so it was like Spike Jones and his City Slickers, or Duke Ellington, or Doris Day, et cetera, Fats Waller. They were just, short 3-minute films, videos of the popular songs of the day. And Kino's putting out a collection of 200 of them on four Blu-rays.
That sounds amazing. I've actually got a couple of the collections of things like that that were put out by the Warner Archive a few years ago, where they did like some of the Vitaphone collections and things like that. And yeah, they're intriguing to take a look at, especially if you put on kind of that mindset of this was, the precursor to MTV, I guess, if you want to call it that.
But other than that, really, it's like whenever there is some sort of classic comedy release that's come out, that's what really, gets me interested. There's been some really nice Abbott and Costello releases recently. The second season of the Abbott and Costello TV show is coming out later this year. And the first season that Classic Flicks put out that was restored by the 3D Film Archive was an excellent release.
Yeah. Well, that's, I guess, a good way to segue into something else I was going to ask you about. And I can't remember back to the previous times you've been on the show. Maybe I asked you this before, but we've always got new listeners. I know that one of your areas that you're particularly fond of is these films of these classic comedians. You know, we're going to be talking about one on this episode. You mentioned Abbott and Costello. Folks like that, there's just wonderful films out there that I think a lot of people don't appreciate as much as they should these days. And I know for me, like, I had a couple of entry drugs to paying attention to these performers. One was that I had a grandfather who would give me old tapes of radio shows and
yep.
like the Abbott and Costello show and Burns and Allen, things like that. And then the other thing was I got for a birthday one year, Leonard Maltin's book about the classic movie comedians. And it went all the way from Charlie Chaplin and Mabel Normand and Buster Keaton all the way up to like Woody Allen, I think was the last chapter of the book. And that just opened my eyes to, you know, a bunch of these classic performers, some who I'd been familiar of, you know, watching on TV, like, you know, the Three Stooges or something like that. And then others that I had no idea about. So I guess what got you into those kind of performers?
I think I discovered them kind of on my own very early on. You know, I was watching Abbott and Costello, certainly, and I think even Chaplin and stuff like that pre-kindergarten. Mm-hmm. You know, WGN in Chicago would show Abbott and Costello movies every Saturday.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think that is what I discovered first. And then my dad, you know, said, you know, oh, you like these guys? Then you'd probably like the Marx Brothers. And I remember like the first film I saw from each of the classic film comedians. So, you know, with the Marx Brothers, it was A Night at the Opera. With W.C. Fields, it was Tilly and Gus. You know, Chaplin, I think it was a double feature of The Gold Rush and The Kid on PBS. You know, so I really just kind of dug in. And I've always been somebody who has been interested in things that came before my time. You know, as a kid, you know, I also would read voraciously about anything that was old, you know, so I also got into classic comic strips. And as you said, old radio shows, you know, I think I kind of came at it from the other angle where, you know, the movies got me into the old radio shows when I realized that a lot of the classic film comedians were on radio as well.
Yeah. Well, let's get on with this movie we have here today. And I guess before we get into what this film is about, let's talk a bit about the star of this movie, who I got to admit, when it comes to the classic movie comedians, this is one who I have not spent as much time with as I should, despite the fact that a couple of years ago I was gifted with a DVD set of 18 of his films. I have barely scratched the surface on it, and so it was great to get to mark this one off my list. But we're talking about Man on the Flying Trapeze from 1935, and this stars W.C. Fields, who I know mainly just kind of from his distinctive look, you know, the big nose, the top hat, the cigar, that type of persona. In fact, I was thinking about it getting ready for the show here. You mentioned WGN in Chicago. I grew up in the Chicago area as well. And I remember growing up watching the show Giggle Snort Hotel, which was a local kids show on local TV there in the Chicago area. And there was a puppet character that was modeled after W.C. Fields on that. Instead of a cigar, he had a big ear of corn that he carried around and held like a cigar.
W.C. But anyway, Cornfields.
Yes. So, but I mean, I've watched lots of movies with the Marx Brothers, the Three Stooges, Abbott and Costello, but W.C. Fields is a bit of a blind spot for me. So tell us a bit about W.C. Fields and why he appeals so much to you.
Well, you know, I think he's not as well known, at least amongst, you know, people under 50. His films just aren't shown as often as, you know, well, certainly the Three Stooges are probably the best remembered of the film comedians, because they did shorts, and they're very television friendly, you know, so there's been a lot of television of that. And Abbott and Costello are somewhat remembered because of their tie to the Universal Monsters, you know, but W.C. Fields hasn't had quite as much attention. And I think it's a shame, because I think he's really the most modern of all of the classic film comedians. You know, he kind of popularized cringe comedy before there was that term, you know, and some misanthropic humor as well. And, you know, his influence, you know, even if the comedians who came later don't even realize that they're influenced by W.C. Fields, he opened a lot of doors, you know, with doing stuff that, you know, wasn't, you know, necessarily, I wouldn't say like it, that was in bad taste, but was more subversive than, you know, a lot of the other comedians of the day. And I think his influence is felt in things that came afterwards, like Fawlty Towers and Blackadder and Seinfeld and, you know, Ghost World and, you know, Bad Santa, et cetera. And I apologize, my dogs are just now going crazy.
That's okay.
They were sleeping right until we started, and then two of them just started going at it.
Well, I've had plenty of that here at my home as well, because we've had a lot of bad weather here recently. So, yeah, no apologies necessary there. Okay, well, let's get on with this movie here. Like we said, Man on the Flying Trapeze. It's from 1935. Directed by Clyde Brookman, though many of the sources out there also say that this was actually co-directed by W.C. Fields and another gentleman named Sam Hardy. But Brookman is the credited director, and he is a guy who worked with many of the big stars of comedy in the silent era and the early sound era. He had a hand in writing many classic comedy films, working with stars like Buster Keaton, Harold Lloyd, Laurel and Hardy, The Three Stooges. Probably the most notable film on his filmography is the Buster Keaton classic, The General. He would, like many, move into television as that media started to grow in the 50s. Though, you know, struggled a bit in that he was actually hired by Abbott and Costello to work on their TV show. But he got into a little bit of trouble because he was reworking a bunch of the classic gags that he had used for decades. And this basically led to a lawsuit. I think it was Harold Lloyd that sued Abbott and Costello's production company. And the result was that many producers were unwilling to work with Brookman anymore. And sadly, then his life took a tragic turn. I don't know that I have all the details here, but the basics of it is that he borrowed a .45 caliber pistol from Buster Keaton, claiming to need it for a hunting trip, and then went to a restaurant in Santa Monica, entered the restroom, and shot himself in the head. He left a note basically saying that he was donating his body to medical or experimental purposes. And yeah, it's a sad story for sure.
Certainly, yes. And, you know, this was the last film that he directed, and it's difficult to tell how much of it he actually directed. There are stories that, you know, he grew ill, and others that it was due to alcoholism, you know, so I really don't know. There are stories both behind the scenes of scenes that he directed and also scenes that Fields directed. And one of the things that it does set this film apart is it's the only known instance where Fields actually is, you know, known to have directed the other actors. I mean, to a large extent, he always directed himself. Nobody could tell him how to do a scene. and he never stuck to the script. He liked to work with directors that would get out of his way.
So this film, of course, stars W.C. Fields. He plays a man named Ambrose Wolfinger. And this is a guy who's got a rough life. He is married to his second wife, who treats him very poorly. Her name is Leona, played by Kathleen Howard. And Ambrose also then has to deal with a bunch of other folks that are all kind of against him. He's got a freeloading brother-in-law named Claude, played by Grady Sutton, and a nasty mother-in-law named Cordella, played by Vera Lewis. As for his job, he works as a memory expert, which is a very important sounding job. Basically, for the president of a manufacturing company, he's tasked with keeping track of all the names and details about the important clients. And so he's pretty indispensable to the company. His coworkers don't really appreciate him, though, or his unconventional style of keeping track of things, which is basically just he's got a big pile of papers that he shoves into his desk. All in all, really the only person in his life that seems to appreciate him is his daughter from his first marriage, Hope, who's played by Mary Bryan. Now, the film is basically a series of vignettes where we have Ambrose in some unusual situations. The film starts with him having to deal with a couple of burglars who break into the house, and they're in the basement, and they get drunk on a stash of Applejack that he's got in the basement. And, I mean, these guys get so sauced that they end up singing, and you know, everybody's going, "There's burglars singing in the basement!" And when Ambrose goes to investigate, he ends up just being a part of the party and ends up then going with the crooks with a police officer to the police station. And in the end, he's the one that gets thrown in prison for making liquor without a license. Then after his daughter, Hope, bails him out, he heads off to work, hoping to get the afternoon off so he can go to a wrestling match. Now, rather than just ask for the time off, he uses the excuse that his mother-in-law has passed away a few days earlier and he has to go to the funeral. So he ends up being given the afternoon off, but then word of his mother-in-law's passing spreads, and then like flowers and cards start showing up at his house, which thoroughly confuses and upsets his wife, not to mention the mother-in-law. And then Ambrose, trying to get to the wrestling match, doesn't have an easy time because he ends up having to deal with traffic problems. There's a bunch of ticket-happy police officers who keep on pulling him over and writing him tickets. He has to deal with a flat tire that starts rolling down the road. He has to chase it off. Plus, he has to deal with the fact that his ticket to the wrestling match got swiped by his no-good brother-in-law, Claude. Now, if you're wondering why this movie is called Man on the Flying Trapeze, well, join the club, because it has nothing to do with the circus, nothing to do with the famous song. Maybe we'll figure it out as we go here, but I'm going to let Garv start us out. Give us a few of your thoughts on Man on the Flying Trapeze.
Well, you know, I believe that the title was just a phrase that Fields liked, a song that Fields liked. Originally, the script, as he was writing it, was called Everything Happens at Once, which really is, you know, what happens in the film. from a lot of reports, too, they didn't have a completed script when they started, and Fields was writing, you know, right ahead of filming, you know, each day. And in fact, at one point they caught up, and, you know, they had to delay a few days as he provided a little bit more for them to do. The film is actually kind of a hybrid remake of two things that Fields had worked on previously. There was a silent film called Running Wild, where he played a meek man who gets hypnotized and doesn't get unhypnotized by accident and becomes a lion, you know, and starts taking on and fighting everybody that he comes across. So it's about, you know, a guy whose situation completely changes. And Fields at this time decided that he wanted to remake the film. But as he was going in, he found that the possibilities of a remake in the sound era didn't really fit real well. The character was screaming all the time, "I'm a lion, I'm a lion." And he thought it would just be kind of irritating. And then he thought back to when he was working doing a series of shorts for Max Sennett. He made four shorts, and the last one, The Fatal Glass of Beer, which I think is the funniest of all of them, was a critical and audience disappointment. His relationship with Sennett fell apart pretty quickly. And Clyde Bruckman, who directed The Fatal Glass of Beer, and him were working on an outline for another short in which, you know, Fields had a lazy, good-for-nothing brother-in-law, and he wanted to go see the fights and get off work, and ran into trouble with his car, etc. And really, it's an expansion on that short, which was never made with Fields, but was actually made as a short called Too Many Highballs with Lloyd Hamilton, a lesser-known comedian. So it's kind of interesting if you go back and watch the earlier film to see how W.C. Fields' material does not work for anyone except W.C. Fields, because the short is not good. But it is interesting seeing some of that material expanded upon in Flying Trapeze. And the thing that's really sets the film apart is that it's really the most personal film that Fields ever made. He really based the characters on members of his own family. You know, he got married in his vaudeville days and was separated when he was 25. And his wife, Hattie, took their infant son, whose name was Claude, with her. And Fields never forgave Hattie or his mother-in-law, who had goaded his wife into leaving him. And he also kind of always looked at his son, at least until later life, as a disappointment, because the boy naturally sided with the mother who took care of him all the time. So, you know, the nagging wife, the disapproving mother-in-law, the adult mama's boy, you know, they were all reflections of the painful relationship that he had with his own family. And in fact, also in the film, at one point, he is, you know, accused of having an affair with his secretary. And his secretary, he hired Carlotta Monti, who was actually his mistress at the time.
Yeah.
So the woman that he's, you know, accused of, you know, having an affair with, he was actually having an affair with. You know, so a lot of things are comic reflections of the pain that he felt in real life. And, you know, really most of Fields' comedy all sprung from the human condition and exaggerated, aggravations of real life.
Well, and that's, I think, an interesting subject to bring up here, because, of course, as I was watching this film, I was like, boy, this is just, you know, this guy has just so many miserable things that he's got to deal with, and just one thing after another. And I'm looking at when this movie came out, and, well, this is right in the heart of the Depression. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a part of me that has to wonder, you know, how much of just kind of the tone and all the things that he's dealing with, how much of that is, you know, kind of a representation of what the country as a whole was dealing with. And, I mean, not to jump to the end too quickly here, but, you know, when we get to the final moments of the film, everything's better and he's got a better outlook on things. And it's almost like this hopeful ending to say to the country in general, hey, folks, we're going to get out of this. You know, it's going to be OK. And your rotten mother-in-law is going to be sitting in the back of the car with a rainstorm pouring down on her.
Yeah. I mean, if I have any sort of criticism of the film, it feels like it ends a little abruptly, but a few ending shots are quite as satisfying as the ending shot of Man of the Flying Trapeze.
Yeah. When I watched this film, it was a really strange experience, I got to admit. I had never seen it before, and I was really excited about watching this because I'd heard other people talk about this one and say that this was one to check out when it came to W.C. Fields and all that. So I was like, all right, here we go. And I watched the film, and it just, the first time watching it, it just didn't gel with me. I don't know what was going on. I mean, I felt like the film kind of meandered and it was slow and it wasn't striking me as all that funny. And I was like, I'm not sure what's wrong with me here, what's going on, because I've heard people talk glowingly about this film. And I was like, you know what, this thing's only 65 minutes long. So a few days later I watched it again, and something just clicked the second time I watched this movie. Suddenly, I don't know, I was just on the right wavelength or something, but this movie's kind of strange, sad sack sort of humor just started to tickle me in the right ways, I guess, watching this. And I don't know. I wonder if other people will have a similar experience with this movie, because I've certainly talked to plenty of people who it just resonates with from the beginning. But I don't know. For me, it took two tries, and I'm glad that I took the effort to watch it a second time.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. You know, I think that for myself, I probably had a similar journey with the film. You know, it's certainly not the first time I've seen it. And actually, before the podcast, I watched it three times, which was not a hardship at all. And again, you know, as you said, you know, it's 65, 66 minutes, you know, which is really the perfect length for a comedy. You know, are you listening, Judd Apatow? but, you know, there's a lot of the best of what Fields can do in the film. But I think the first time that I watched it, I think it was all of the depressing incidents. You know, there W.C. Fields never played a character that had more reason to drink than Ambrose Wolffinger.
Yes, you know? Yes.
So, yeah, I think I kind of felt that way, where I didn't connect with it quite in the same way that I connected with It's a Gift or The Bank Dick, which is, you know, those are his two most popular, you know, comedies. But personally, it's like the more I watch this particular one, the more I'm becoming convinced that it might be his best.
Well, and I think one of the things that's strange about that is that, and maybe I just haven't watched enough of his films, but it struck me that he's playing a very different kind of character than what I had in my mind as the type of character that he plays. Because I usually think of him as being a bit of a wise guy. You know, he's got a quick response to things, and he's, you know, a little bit of a con man and that. And here he's just this somber, beaten down guy, and he's just kind of trudging through life and, you know, snatching rare moments of joy with his daughter and all that. But he's just, well, this is my lot in life, and I'm going to soldier through here, and that's the way it is. And it just, I was like, that is not what I was expecting out of W.C. Fields.
Yeah, well, you know, Fields is also unique amongst the classic film comedians in that he really didn't have a set character from film to film. You know, most comedians, you know, found something that clicked with the audience. You know, Chaplin found the little tramp character in his second film, and, you know, in like 1914, and he stuck with that until The Great Dictator in like 1940. You know, and once Laurel and Hardy found their Derby characters, you know, they stuck with that until the end of their careers, you know, but Fields would play a variety of characters. They were all W.C. Fields, but they were different aspects of his personality. So sometimes he was an ill-mannered authority figure. More often, you know, he was an underdog. And his two most common characters, you know, were either the con man, you know, the huckster, you know, which was a variation on his stage success in the Broadway play Poppy, or he played a harried, henpecked family man. And it's actually the family man films that are his best films. But I think that a lot of people have a skewed view of him because a lot of people are just more familiar, if they even know who W.C. Fields is nowadays. But, you know, I think they're more familiar with bad imitations of W.C. Fields than of W.C. Fields himself. You know, and I in the 1960s, there was a bit of a revival in interest in subversive comedians. So the Marx Brothers and W.C. Fields, you know, there was a lot of interest in their films. But, you know, they really did tend to focus on the more conniving character, you know, than on the family man, you know, especially in people imitating.
Yeah, him. Yeah. Well, I mean, when you compare what he does in this film to, you know, what you see out of those other comedy acts, I mean, you know, especially like the Marx Brothers or something like that, there's something wonderfully subtle about what he's doing in this film. I mean, it's, you know, a comedic scenario we've seen many times, you know, the ultimate bad day type of thing where just one bad thing after another. It struck me how he just never has that moment of explosion, of anger, of, you know, he can't take it anymore type of thing. I mean, his biggest reaction in this whole thing, and it's one of my favorite moments of the film, is towards the beginning when is the whole burglar singing in the cellar thing. And he gets the gun out of the drawer, and then he's saying, "Yeah, there's no bullets. It's fine. It's fine." And he it actually accidentally goes off, and his wife screams and falls to the bed. And he says, "Did I kill you?" And then she says, "Oh, just leave." And he's like, "Oh, I didn't kill you." It's almost like he's for a moment excited that he might have accidentally shot her.
Yeah, he does, you know, at the very end, you know, when Claude, you know, kind of threatens his daughter, you know, that sets him off. And he, you know, takes a swing and knocks Claude out and then takes a swing at his mother-in-law as well. You know, I'll knock him for a row of lip labs. You know, so, you know, he does have very small explosions, but, you know, that's not a major part of the character in this particular film.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even the type of thing where you've got, like, extreme, like, you know, expressions, you know, a wide-eyed look at something, you know, like you see out of a lot of comedians. So, no, it's something pretty unique. And I think that also just there are other elements of the character in general that are unique. I love just this strange job that he has, you know, where it's, I mean, he's basically like the living equivalent of, you know, what people use their phones for, you know, all the time now to keep track of all this different stuff. You know, he is the guy with all the knowledge about the clients for this company. And he manages it all with, you know, scraps of paper that he has everywhere, which I got to admit, watching that made me chuckle a bit because it reminded me of someone that I worked with for 25 years who just was not a computer guy, never did any of that stuff, but he always had a legal pad with him and was always scribbling things down. He had papers everywhere, you know, and nobody could make sense of his system but him. So it was kind of fun to see that. But I love the scene where he's brought in to talk to his boss and he rattles off all the information about this Australian guy that's coming and, you know, even sharing some things about the last time that his boss went out with this guy. And, you know, he's almost got this little slyness to the way he's saying things, almost like he's kind of saying, "I'm hiding some information here that you don't want me to share in front of your secretary," you know, and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and that's one of those scenes, you know, again, Fields never stuck to a script, and I really think that he, you know, elaborated a bit as he was going on there. You know, I doubt that, you know, lines like, he had a friend with him, the Miffin-Tiff of Boffindale, an Indian potentate. You know, yes. I doubt that was in the script.
Yeah. Speaking of the various, I guess, you know, segments, the various vignettes here, like we said, I mean, we have a story, but it's a lot of it's not all that connected. It's kind of, you know, we get these little bits and pieces of this ultimate bad day for him. So I guess what stands out to you as being kind of some of the highlights when it comes to the different segments, the different sketches, so to speak, that make up this film?
Well, you know, probably the most famous of all of the scenes in the film is the scene where he gets four or more parking tickets in a row.
Yeah.
You know, and that is a scene that was, you know, well, to a certain extent was developed for that earlier Max Sennett short. But, you know, when you watch that short, the comedy is just about a car getting stuck between two other, you know, vehicles where, you know, there's nothing about the parking tickets or anything like that. That was all elaborated for this film. And it's just a wonderful things stacking and escalating and getting progressively worse. When you're dealing with cops, there's just nothing you can do. So, you know, he's completely helpless. And, you know, it's just a wonderful scene.
It is a great scene. That was the one that definitely jumped out to me as well. There's just, I don't know, again, a wonderful timing that's involved in that. One of my favorite moments of that bit is where you have two cops there at the same time questioning him, and one asked him the question, and another one, the other one asked him the exact same question, and all that stuff. Again, Fields is just going through it with this strange kind of subtle approach that just works so well. The opening sequence also is just is a lot of fun. It was really weird to me. It was, I don't know, it was an odd way to start the film, because I mean, really kind of the first big comedic beat of that whole thing is, you know, these two crooks who show up to rob the house randomly and you know, realize they've been sent to do the same job. And then they start singing and all this stuff. And I'm like, where is this film going? This is bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you watch many, you know, W.C. Fields films, you'll find that all of them are just as unconnected, you know, in terms of, you know, the scenes and things like that. A lot of the material kind of developed from some of this stage sketches that he did, you know, in vaudeville or on Broadway, you know, so he would incorporate some of that, but he would get ideas for particular scenes and put them together. And you didn't necessarily always have a coherent storyline. It was just important that each scene be funny,
mm-hmm.
you know, but yes, it is. I laugh from beginning to end, you know, in that particular scene, you know, starting, you know, the film starts with him, you know, trying to avoid his wife, you know, drinking in the bathroom, pretending to brush his teeth. And you have all of the various, you know, I love the way he's woken up being told that there's burglars singing in the cellar, you know, and stuff. And most people would be, you know, frightened of burglars. And he's just upset at the imposition. Why couldn't they have waited until later on in the morning? And then he goes and listens through the vent and is like, oh, what rotten voices.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and even as the scene progresses, I mean, it's just like everything that happens to him, he's just like, well, of course, you know, because bad things just happen to me. I mean, even when he bursts through the cellar door and falls down the steps and he lands on a board with a nail sticking out of it, you know, pulls it out of his backside and it looks at it and he says, oh, why couldn't it have been a small, dull one? And it's like, yep. It's almost like he's accepted that he's going to end up sitting on a nail, but maybe it could have been a small, dull one instead of a big, long one, you know?
Yep. There is a little bit of, you know, everything again of, you know, what Fields could do. You know, the only thing you really don't get, you know, in this film is you don't get his juggling. You know, he started out as a juggler, you know, and became a comedian over time. He, you know, added, you know, some asides and jokes, you know, to the juggling. And over time, the act became more jokes than juggling. So you don't really get that in the film. But apart from that, you get some heart. You know, he always wanted heart, you know, with the character. There's a beautiful scene between him and his daughter in the car when he's driving to work. And mm-hmm. his daughter talks about how, you know, she was talking to someone who had told that he would never have married a second time, except that Hope needed a mother. And it is just a nice, beautiful scene between the two of them. There's a lot of comedy based on the human condition. There's a little bit of venom here and there in a lot of his muttered asides. You know, Fields is a lot like Popeye. You know, the best material he says under his breath. And there's even some dark humor. The scene where he is put in jail and he's in a jail cell with a man who killed his wife with a pair of scissors.
Yes.
And it's a really uncomfortable scene. You know, I've had three wives, but this is the first one I've killed in all my life. Yeah. And Fields is just trying to get the guard's attention. You know, I think he's got some scissors hidden in here someplace. And then there's a lot of, you know, little bits of surrealism and meta humor that he often would do. I mean, the wrestling match is completely ridiculous, you know. Mm-hmm. And by the way, one of the wrestlers, I don't know if you noticed, is Tor Johnson.
Yeah.
Although bearded in this, fake bearded. And I love the names of the wrestlers, Toss Off, the Russian Behemoth, and Hukalaka Mishabob, the Persian Giant. But then there's like the scene where he gets a flat tire, and as he's trying to change the tire, you know, his car gets backed into and the tire starts going downhill and he starts chasing after it. And eventually he's chasing after the tire on the railroad tracks with the train barreling down. And for most other comics, you know, if it was Keaton or if it was Harold Lloyd, the whole joke would be about the impending danger of the train, you know, coming at him. Mm-hmm. But since this is a W.C. Fields film, instead, it's a meta joke about bad back projection. You know, so you know, it's just he knows it looks silly when he's running with the back projection and the tire. And so, you know, he just makes it as ridiculous as possible. And that's the joke. It really doesn't have, you know, yeah. You never feel danger for a second.
No. You've got like a tire's eye view of the shot as the thing is rolling down the road. Yeah, it's fun. I want to jump back to what you were saying about the scene with the daughter, which I agree was a really touching scene, really, to be honest. And, you know, kind of gave some context as to why he puts up with all that he does. And I really enjoyed this actress, Mary Bryan, who plays the daughter. You know, when I saw her first show up in this film, and you kind of get an idea of Fields' character and then the wife and the mother-in-law, the no good brother-in-law, all that stuff, you go, all right, well, here's the daughter is the one kind of ray of sunshine in this. And she's got the role where you see it in other films from these classic comedians like, you know, the Marx Brothers or Abbott and Costello, where it's the pretty person role, you know, where like Abbott and Costello are always teamed up with some handsome guy who is, you know, maybe he's a singer or something like that. And he's, you know, wooing the pretty girl and all that. And they're like the non-comedic element of the story. And to be honest with you, in some ways, those are the parts of those Marx Brothers movies and those Abbott and Costello movies that bug me the most. But here, I was expecting that out of the daughter, and she totally wasn't. She is her own character. She's strong. She stands up for herself. She stands up for her father. And this is not just we got to put someone who's not a goofball in this movie. This is a legit character that really gave the whole story and the whole kind of context of what Fields is dealing with a lot broader picture, I guess. And I really appreciated that.
Yeah. And again, it all goes back to, you know, the film being extremely personal. Not only are the family members, you know, based on members of his own family, Fields often would tell people that, you know, if I only had a daughter, she would understand me, you know, and so this was, you know, his fantasy daughter in this particular film, and he insisted on Mary Bryan for the part. She had played his daughter in the silent film Running Wild that this is a somewhat remake of. And she played his daughter in another silent as well that I believe is lost. You know, most of the films that Fields made in the silent era are lost. But Fields was extremely loyal to his friends and to actors and people that he respected and liked. So you'll see a lot of the same actors come up, you know, from film to film. And a lot of people assume that Fields was difficult to work with, but, you know, the actors that work with him generally had, you know, really beautiful, pleasant memories of working with him and had nothing but great things to say about him. That he was only difficult to work with if you were like the studio head or the producer, you know, because, you know, Fields had the best idea of how to present his own comedy. The other thing that I did want to mention, too, about the heart of the film, you know, this is one of the few films that he actually was able to get that in and keep it in. You know, a lot of times they would film scenes or he would write scenes for even his con man characters, where it would show a softer side of them to give the audience a reason to root for the character. And then the studio, they'd edit it out. And a lot of the critics would complain, well, this character is totally unlikable or whatever. And Fields would just butt his head against the wall. It's like, I'm trying, but they keep taking it away from me.
Well, before we take it to the break here, I do want to give a little bit of love to some of these supporting players. We've just mentioned their characters, but I feel like we should call some of them out because they do a great job here. We mentioned Mary Bryan, but Kathleen Howard plays the wife, and she is just delightfully awful to him. It's kind of like she approaches the delivery, her voice is kind of like, makes me think of like Margaret Dumont or something like that, but she's so nasty. She is so nasty. Margaret Dumont is lovable. Kathleen Howard is just nasty in this.
If you want a shrewish wife, the best thing to do is hire an opera singer. that's how Kathleen Howard started out. She was an opera contralto, and she also is his wife in It's a Gift, and she was also in the film You're Telling Me, an earlier Fields film. She played a snobbish society woman in that, not his wife. But she's an actress that he loved working with, and apparently she loved working with him, too.
We also got to mention the mother-in-law. the mother-in-law, I mean, she might as well be auditioning for the Wicked Witch of the West here. She's got that scowl,
Oh, yeah.
And I love just the idea that, she is so wrapped up in her no-good son. He can do no wrong. The scene, again, where they're all talking about the burglar singing in the basement and Fields is about to go down there and he says, "Come on, Claude." And she's like, "No, he can't go. I would die of a heart attack if anything were to happen to Claude." But yeah, again, just another great character actress here.
Yes. Honestly, I don't know all that much about her, but she does do a wonderful job in the part. And, it's a wonderful turn of events where she is so anti-drinking, anti-liquor, and then for it to be printed in the papers that she died from drinking poisoned liquor. it's just a wonderful turn.
All right. Well, before we wrap it up here on this one, any closing thoughts on this film?
I would just encourage anybody that hasn't looked into the films of W.C. Fields to give him a try. My wife, for example, doesn't really share the same love of the classic film comedians that I do. Just like you, when I was a kid, Leonard Maltin's The Great Movie Comedians, that was my Bible. My wife, especially slapstick, she's not a big fan of. But there have been times where she has said to me, "Hey, would you put on that fatal glass of beer?" She gets Fields. And, as I said, I think he really is the most modern of the film comedians. Something like The Office owes a debt to him. The cringe comedy, the darker comedy, the more subtle comedy. He was a little different. So I would say, give Fields a try. And the best three movies to start with are It's a Gift, Man on the Flying Trapeze, and The Bank Dick.
Yep. I've seen Bank Dick. I haven't seen It's a Gift yet, so got to get to that one. But yeah, I would definitely recommend this as well. But again, kind of just going off of my experience, it may be one that you need to be in the right frame of mind for, or maybe even, take a second viewing on it, because, I don't know why it didn't click the first time, but the second time was just joyous. So this one was a lot of fun. All right. We'll take a quick break here. We'll hear from another LAMP Podcasting Network show, and then we'll be back with our movie recommendations here on the Forgotten Filmcast.
You'll save money and time. You'll get the best of merchandise and service when you patronize these good neighbors. Shop with them regularly for friendly service and money-saving values.
Hi, everyone. This is Tim Costa.
I'm Hermano da Silva.
And this is Walter Vinci.
And together we are the First Time Watchers Podcast.
Each week we choose a movie to review that none of us has seen.
Watch it together.
And then discuss.
These movies could be new.
Or old.
Or on our list of shame.
You can find us on iTunes by searching for the First Time Watchers Podcast.
As well as on Stitcher.
And we love interacting with our listeners, so if you have any suggestions, send us a tweet.
An email.
Or post to our Facebook page.
We'd love to hear from you.
That's right. I mean, it's all about interaction.
And talk about what we love, movies.
And you don't have to worry about us going on and on about this and that and the other. And
Shut up.
Hi, everybody. This is Todd. Just a quick reminder that you can help support the Forgotten Filmcast through Patreon. For just a few little old measly dollars a month, you can support this show and earn access to some great bonus features, including a bunch of the early episodes of this show that are no longer available on the main podcast feed. So visit patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast to learn more.
Hi, I'm Chili Dilly, the personality pickle. Packed in a jar for the freshest flavor. Served cold in a sack for you to savor. So dainty to eat, no muss, no fuss. An ideal snack for all of us. Crisp, tender, and tasty with a bit of spice. Buy one now. Taste how nice. Snack bar clerks will knock themselves silly. Speeding your order for a real Chili Dilly.
Okay, welcome back. It's time for our movie recommendations. This is the part of the show where each of us gets to talk about another movie, something that we've enjoyed that we want to tell others about. It could be anything. It could be a forgotten film, could be something new in theaters, something on streaming, could be an old classic. Possibilities are endless. So, Garv, what is your recommendation?
Well, I wanted to stay thematic. So I picked a film where circumstances change for a downtrodden underdog. And I thought I'd also choose someone whose work I think, you know, was either influenced by W.C. Fields or influenced by other people who were influenced by W.C. Fields. So consequently, I'm choosing the film The Invention of Lying. From 2009, which was co-written, co-directed, and stars Ricky Gervais.
Speaking of The Office, yes.
Yes. I don't know if it's a film that you've seen.
I have seen it. It's been quite a while, but yeah, I have seen it.
Okay. Well, you know, it's a film set in an alternative universe where mankind developed without discovering that it was possible to say something that wasn't. In other words, nobody knows how to lie. Consequently, there's no such thing as fiction or flattery. And you quickly find out that if people had no choice but to tell the truth all the time, that people would be absolutely horrible to each other, you know. And people in the film are constantly telling Ricky Gervais that he's overweight and he's not very attractive, and that they don't like him, you know, and they're actively working against him, you know, et cetera. So, you know, he works as a writer for lecture films. You know, there are only nonfiction films in this world. And he's about to get fired because he got stuck with the 14th century and people just aren't interested in seeing movies about the Black Plague. And he's also has a crush on a girl played by Jennifer Garner, who is way out of his league and, you know, has no problem telling him so. And he's about to be evicted because, you know, getting fired, he can't pay his rent. So he goes to the bank to pull out his last remaining funds to rent a truck to take his belongings out of the apartment. And suddenly he has a bolt out of the blue. And he suddenly tells the bank teller that he has more money in his account than he actually has. And being that there is no concept of lying, they believe him. You know, so suddenly he has this superpower that nobody else has, and things do completely turn around for him. The nice thing, too, is they're very smart with the script, and they keep the idea from getting creepy. Yeah, you know, for example, you know, his character decides very, very early on that it would be immoral to take advantage of women through this power that he has. But overall, it's a really nice romantic comedy with fantasy elements. And in a way, it kind of reminded me of Albert Brooks' Defending Your Life or something along that line.
I was thinking the same thing, yes.
The only thing I will say is if you are a religious fundamentalist, this isn't the movie for you, you know, because it does take a few jabs at organized religion. You know, Ricky Gervais is an avowed atheist. But, you know, honestly, those jabs are much gentler and much more humane than you would expect.
Yeah, given Ricky Gervais's behavior on a lot of awards show, this whole movie is probably a lot gentler than you might expect.
True, true, true. And also, it just has an amazing cast. You know, you know, Jennifer Garner, Rob Lowe, the now canceled Louis C.K., Jonah Hill, Tina Fey, Jeffrey Tambor, even, you know, people like Philip Seymour Hoffman shows up in a scene. Edward Norton shows up in a scene. You know, Jason Bateman shows up in a scene. Christopher Guest is there. You know, it seems like everybody, you know, was, you know, just kind of wanted to get in on this project.
Well, yeah, that's a great recommendation. I haven't thought about that movie in a long time, but I remember enjoying it. So, yeah, another one to check out again.
Yeah, if you have Canopy through your public library, it's currently streaming for free on Canopy, and then it's easy to find on other rental services. It's like a $3 rental otherwise.
Well, the movie that I'm going to recommend, I really kind of went back and forth a bit about what to recommend. I thought I could do another W.C. Fields film because I have seen some of them, not a ton. And there's one that I really enjoyed that I watched, a couple years ago. I think I watched it during the pandemic, called Million Dollar Legs, which I think is great. When I watched it, I was like, oh, this should run on a double feature with Duck Soup. You know, it's just... There's similar concepts, but that's not going to be my recommendation. I decided to do something that I've never done before on the show here, and that is I'm going to recommend a short. And the reason for that is because when I hear that name of this movie we talked about, Man on the Flying Trapeze, it of course makes me think of the song. And when I hear the song, I think of this short. And it is a 1934 entry in the R-Gang series called Mike Fright.
Okay.
So this is one that centers on a radio broadcast of a kid's talent show. And the station manager is trying to convince an important sponsor that this is the show to put your money behind and that. So he's got all sorts of classy acts lined up for this show. And at the last minute, then he gets a phone call from an act that really wants to be on the show, the International Silver String Submarine Band, which is, of course, the Gang. Okay, so they show up at the radio station with their instruments that are all made out of junk and things like that, and they then proceed to innocently sabotage the big broadcast. Now, this film, I watched it tons of times growing up. You know, they would show the Little Rascals shorts on TV on Channel 32 in Chicago every summer. Mm-hmm. And this is one that I saw all the time. One of the things that I really love about this short is that a lot of it is made up of these precocious kiddie musical acts. And it's wonderfully subversive what Hal Roach and his crew are doing here, because the R Gang films were so popular that there was this constant stream of stage mothers that were bringing their children to the studio to audition. They all thought, my kid's going to be a movie star. And Hal Roach rarely went for those kids, you know, to cast in his movies. He went for these ones that were a little bit more rough and tumble. And in this film, he puts a bunch of these precocious acts in the film to essentially poke fun at them and their annoying parents. And so we have these strange kiddie acts going on, and then the gang are, you know, basically kind of making them all look ridiculous. And it's just kind of a wonderful way of Hal Roach kind of saying to all these parents that were dragging their kids into his studio, you know, I'm tired of you. I'm sick of this. You know, the gang, of course, the cast of the R Gang films changed a lot over the years. And this group is one of my favorites when it comes to the rotating cast members that we had. In this short, we've got Matthew Beard, a.k.a. Stymie. Tommy Bond is in here. This is many years before he would become the bully of the series, Butch. But when he was young and had a kind of a mop-top hair, he was kind of a different character called Tommy. And he's always been one of my favorites. And then, of course, you've got young Spanky McFarland here and his sidekick at the time, Scotty Beckett, and they steal several scenes in this film. I mean, all of the gang members have great moments. One of my favorite scenes here is one that my son and I quote all the time. Anytime we've got lemons in the house for some reason, we say, "You like lemons? They're good for your freckles." Because there's this scene where the gang starts eating lemons as Leonard Kibrick starts trying to play the trumpet on the big broadcast, and he starts puckering up and he can't play the trumpet and all that. Yeah, classic for me. But long story short, the reason this came to mind is when the gang finally gets the chance to perform and do their big number, the song they perform is The Man on the Flying Trapeze. So whenever I see that title, hear that song name, I think of this short. It's one of my favorites of the R Gang series.
Yeah, and those films have been lovingly restored, you know, and there's a great series of classic flicks Blu-rays out now if people want to see those films, you know, better than you've ever seen them.
Absolutely. Well, Garv, I want to thank you for being on the show. Please remind everybody of where they can find you and the different things you've got going on out there.
Well, you can find my website at bottomshelfmovies.com, and you can search for that also on Facebook. You know, I'm at It Came From the Bottom Shelf. Also, that's my Instagram handle. I am still on Twitter, which is at Bottom Shelf Movies, except it's spelled BTTM. SHLF movies. Yeah, so it was too long to do the whole thing, so I had to remove some of the vowels. But you can find me if you search for It Came From the Bottom Shelf or for William Garver on a lot of the social media.
Fantastic. Thanks again for being on the show, and I'll be back to close things here in just a moment here on the Forgotten Filmcast.
Thanks again.
Well, everybody, that's going to do it for episode 190 of the Forgotten Filmcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to read some more reviews of Forgotten Films, you can find them over at the Forgotten Films blog. That's at forgottenfilmcast.wordpress.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Forgotten Films. That's films with a Z. And you can like Forgotten Films at Facebook. I'd love to hear your questions, comments, and feedback about the show. So please email me at forgottenfilmcast@gmail.com. And don't forget about our Patreon page, patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, go watch a few old movies. We'll see you again real soon.
Yeah, there's burglars singing in the cellar.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.